Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. As a teenager, ceramicist Roberto Lugo viewed a crumbling brick wall in his North Philly neighborhood as a canvas for personal expression. These days, the Penn State graduate, social activist, spoken word poet, and educator, with an aesthetic all his own, is creating hip-hop and graffiti-influenced porcelain that's been celebrated nationwide. His teapots and vases are reimagined with hand-painted portraits of influential people of color like Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass, and Snoop Dogg, brown faces on what one might ordinarily see as luxury vessels reserved for the very rich. Roberto Lugo joins us in our studio. He lives in Marlborough, Vermont, with his wife and young son, and is a ceramics professor at Marlborough College. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, I'm very excited to be here.
You say pottery saved your life.
Yeah, pottery saved my life. I think that's so true. I mean, in some ways, it connects to this artist named Mark Echo, who's I guess, more known nowadays as a fashion designer, but he started off as a graffiti artist. And did you. Yeah, and one of the first things he wrote was, graffiti saved my life, and then eventually, they made that into a T-shirt, and he then had a T-shirt that said, "Graffiti made me rich." And I don't think he's made a T-shirt like that ever since. But one of the reasons why I say specifically pottery is just because it gave me a place to focus my energy and to give me an opportunity. But in reality, there's like a bigger implication there, because if you think about pottery saving one's life for that opportunity, what's really implied is that education or like opportunity saved my life. And so that really, attaches itself to many different fields.
You've said more than once that you had an inadequate education.
Yeah.
You grew up in the hardscrabble neighborhood of Kensington in North Philadelphia, and there were no summer school art programs. You never even touched a potter's wheel until you were 25 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it's not like I didn't try. You know, there's just moments where we'd have cable TV for, you know, a good month before they shut it off. And there's this one show called Salute Your Shorts. And on the show, it give a picture of all these white kids at a summer camp. And I wanted so desperately to be in that position that I took it upon myself as an 11-year-old to look through the yellow pages at summer camps and call around and find newspapers. And the closest thing I could find was a YMCA summer camp. And then, you know, I asked how much it was, and it was about $300. And I never asked my parents if we could do that, because I knew what the answer was. And even back then, I was so empathetic that I didn't want to put them in that position to feel bad that they couldn't afford to send me to something. But I knew early on that I had an interest. I didn't realize that it was in the arts, but in something outside of where I found myself in that community. And so one of the things I often did to start doing graffiti, what I was just buy sheets of poster board. There's a place around the corner that sold poster board for a nickel, and I would go and I'd buy, you know, 10 of them and go over to my cousin's house, who I knew were graffiti artists, and I'd ask them to fill up the pages. And through that process, they taught me how to do it as well.
You use the word ghetto self-referentially. You say, "I am a ghetto potter," but not with the judgment that usually, you know, the connotation that is usually loaded into that word. And in fact, online, there is this really incredibly powerful video that you have titled "Ghetto is Resourceful." And your father, who's a first-generation immigrant from Puerto Rico and a pastor, was certainly resourceful. Talk a little bit about what ghetto means to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think ghetto kind of allows me to take ownership of my own upbringing. And I think one of the things that maybe people often find distasteful about ghetto is that it stigmatizes an entire neighborhood. But I tend to think about ghetto as sort of like a frame of mind, like the notion that one could be a prisoner in their own mind. And in my case, I was ghetto in my own mind. And for a lot of people, yes, there's this negative connotation. But in the case of the video, ghetto is resourceful. What I was really trying to do was reclaim it to have it connect to people in a different way. So there's this big DIY movement. We see it a lot on, you know, HGTV and you know, people building tiny homes. And so being resourceful and DIY is sort of this really positive thing. And often when I think about being ghetto, I'm thinking about folks doing the same thing, but with found materials. And so my father was that way. He'd convert old washing machines into large food processors. And so, you know, he turned old tires into planters. And we just, you know, one time we needed a grater, a cheese grater. And so he took a tin can lid from an old can of crackers and just banged a screwdriver through it till it became a rasp. And then you could grate cheese on it. And all these things lead me to be who, you know, I am today in terms of my practice and being resourceful. And so I really wanted to take ownership of that because I spent so much of my life being ashamed of where I came from. And then now it's really important for me to claim that in order to make others who come from similar places know that they have options.
Talk a little bit about your first experience with clay. As I said, you were 25 years old the first time you threw clay on a wheel and made something of it.
Yeah, clay was a bit different than I had. I'd started in a class next door to the pottery studio, and one of the reasons
when you were in college, undergraduate school,
community college, yeah. And I specifically went to community college because I moved away from Philadelphia to get away from all this bad news and all these things that were happening around me. And so I found myself in Florida, and my cousin, who is there, said, you could take a community college class for $200. So I said, well, that's affordable. And so I went and I was looking through the book, and the first section was the ART section, one of the first sections. And I said, if I'm going to go for something, I want it to be fun. And so I took a drawing class, and the teacher was a potter. And I'd always noticed all this noise happening in the pottery studio, like people having a good time. And one of the reasons why I went to community college was to have a sense of community and to be around people my age. And so the first time I tried the potter's wheel, it was different than the rest of the visual arts because it was more sort of like tangible and the process was more pragmatic. And it reminded me of something that my father could do because it was sort of like learning how to operate a machine rather than learning how to make art. And the idea of art confused me because I didn't really connect to what a lot of people saw as art. But the idea of being able to make something and use a machine properly connected with me because of the sort of blue-collaredness of it. If that makes sense.
It does. And, you know, your pots, which are, you know, often these century vases, if people know what we're talking about, these aristocratic looking, delicate teapots and vessels, you reimagine them with hip hop lyrics on them and graffiti images on them. And your pots have been compared to Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Like Miranda, you are trying to start a conversation. So I'm wondering what sort of motivates all of the work you've done over these past 8 or 10 years?
Yeah, you know, I kind of feel like my work is really just a composite of who I am. And it's great for me, being somebody who's been traveling a little bit and hearing how people interpret my work, because my art, I guess, is like the way that I want to look. You know, like I've felt so insecure about who I am, where I come from, and how I look at my work. If somebody says it's beautiful, it kind of makes me feel good about myself. And so it's a way for me to be able to get what's inside out. And so I kind of feel like I couldn't really make anything else, you know, because of my experiences. I've tried to sort of like fit in and make things to sort of people please and support criticism that I've received. And at the end of the day, the only thing that people have really responded to are things that come from my own personal experience. And so what I realized was that it is important for me to talk about my past because there's so few people working in not only the visual arts, but specifically in ceramics. There are people of color working in clay, but there are very, very few people working in clay that are also from neighborhood like mine. And so that's why the work seems so new, because we're sort of right now at a point in history where someone who came from that could even go to college. You know, people forget how long ago, you know, we became desegregated in schools and how long ago Puerto Ricans had just gotten here. And so it makes sense that right now this is a time in our lives where we can see someone like myself go to school for something as that might seem so arbitrary as ceramics. And, you know, just to give you a quick hint of that, you know, in my family, boys weren't really required to go to high school. The women had to go to high school, but the men, we just had to get through middle school. Then we had to get a job. And so I worked at a factory after school, a Christmas wreath factory, which is kind of cool, actually. But I did that every day after school so that I can continue my studies. They weren't really supported. The educators at my schools weren't really very high quality educators at the first high school I went to. But the point is that I could understand looking at that history why there's so few folks that wind up working in clay that come from a similar background.
A lot of your work has been in collaboration with other artists, and the collaboration that stands out for me is the work you've done with Richard Ross, the photographer from the University of California at Santa Barbara. His body of work, his project, the Juvenile Injustice Project, is about really shining a light on juvenile detention and the treatment of young people in prison. Why were you drawn to work with him, and why in general is collaboration with other artists so important to what you do?
That's a great question. So Richard Ross came here to Penn State while I was a graduate student as a visiting artist, and to be honest, aesthetically and in many ways just the direction of our work, it didn't make too much sense for us to exhibit together, but I knew that he was doing critiques with some photography students, and so I didn't get a chance to sign up for critique because it was really for the photo students, but I winded up making my way there anyway, and I put a bunch of my pottery in my backpack, and I went to that critique, and I sat around and waited and asked him if he'd look at some of my stuff. And my artwork at that time certainly did not relate to what he was doing, but what did relate was my story. And my background related to him working with juveniles in detention centers, a lot of juveniles that looked like me, and my brother had just been arrested, and I'm going to graduate school for art, and my brother's locked up. And so all these things were happening within my life, and I knew that this person was somebody who was interested in dealing with people like myself, but I wanted to represent to him what potential, what possibilities someone like myself, someone like the people that he's documenting in these books, has the potential to do if given the opportunity. And so when I showed him my work, he asked to exhibit with me. But really, since then, the reason why I exhibit is because I don't think that my work tells the whole story. And so I have a real problem with doing a solo exhibition. I often collaborate with other artists by either showing their artwork alongside of me or by literally collaborating to create one piece of work, just because I feel like what I do is a good supplement to the conversation, but it's not the entirety of it. And so by allowing me to give an opportunity for someone else to have their voice heard, I feel like it becomes more comprehensive and really engages people in a more broad way.
You know, Ross's work actually became a catalyst for changing legislation on juvenile incarceration. And I'm wondering, in your eyes, is that really the power and the purpose of art?
Yeah, I think it certainly can be. And I think it's important. This conversation is important because we recently had this uproar with the Dana Schutz painting. Dana Schutz painted Emmett Till at the Whitney Biennial. And Emmett Till was killed by police in the 50s. And his mother had an open casket. But the complaint was that, you know, this woman did not have the agency to make the work because she was using this Black Death and the violence of it as a spectacle in order to sort of get some notoriety. And I think what people confuse is that as a white person, you can certainly be an ally and you can certainly be someone that supports a conversation. And I think that's an even more important conversation because Richard Ross doesn't need to use these folks as a spectacle. He's like using it to like change legislation to support and help and let these folks know that they have an ally, which I think is a really important part of it. And then also, you know, Black folks, Hispanic folks, Indigenous folks can all make work about what they want to make work about. And it can be about the same content what Richard Ross is talking about, but it could be about something else. And in many ways, these two things really relate because what they're doing is they're complicating the conversation and letting people know that not all Black people or Hispanic people come from the same places or the same backgrounds. And so we really need a diverse representation within that diversity. We really need for folks to know that, you know, people of color come from all walks and they have all different interests. Myself, most people wouldn't look at me and immediately say, oh, that looks like a potter, you know. And so I love the fact that I don't look like what you would imagine a potter would look like. I don't know. A guy with a mustache and flannel. You know, maybe I wear flannel, but you know what I mean. And I have a mustache.
In fact, you put a lot of brown faces on your pottery. Everything from, you know, Snoop Dogg to Frederick Douglass. And you say you want people to become accustomed to seeing that on this fine porcelain china that you're working with.
Yeah, and I think there's this sort of like beauty in this idea that eventually my work will be boring, and I'm really attracted to that because if putting a person of color on a pot is somehow like a juxtaposition or exciting,
revolutionary,
that means we're at a certain part of the world where that hasn't been done yet. But when people are exhausted by it or feel like it's just sort of run of the mill, then that means that they're used to that. And for me, that's really exciting. And, you know, it's interesting to be an artist and in some ways get recognition for your work. But in reality, what I hope to eventually do is be unrecognizable and just be sort of one stone in within millions of stones or within that pathway.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and today's guest is potter, social activist, spoken word poet, and educator Roberto Lugo. Long before he became a potter, he was a graffiti artist in the hardscrabble Kensington neighborhood of North Philly. Today, he's a tenure-track professor of ceramics at Marlborough College in Vermont. His artwork has been shown in dozens of exhibitions and has garnered nationwide attention. You mentioned critics a little bit earlier, and there have been some, not many, but some critics who say that you've made pottery political.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, in my opinion, pottery is what we use to identify politics today. I would render to say that pottery has always been political. You know, if you like look at Greek pottery and they're exhibiting their aristocracy and the rich and showing folks sitting, laying down, eating, and they're showing war and they have the money to be able to support these works being made and get to sort of manufacture these objects that represent what's important to them. I think that is inherently political because it sort of, that's what people use visually to gauge what's valuable and what's important. And so much of the work that I've seen, for example, porcelain at one point was considered more expensive than gold, and so wars were fought over it. And so just having a porcelain object in your house really exhibited, your family's wealth. And the fight for that, you know, that
so it's not an accident that you're using this image of aristocracy to put your very modern, take on it.
Yeah. It's certainly not an accident. And it's almost like I would love to see the day where me doing what I do is not political. It's only political because of the world that we live in right now. You know, and I think if we were to see more artists of color working in clay or working just in the visual arts, then what I'm doing would not be political, you know? And so I think it's just because of that lack of representation, people may see it that way. Because people that come from different backgrounds, often, you know, you can't really make work outside of anything that you know. And so a lot of the people are making work about, or abstracting or making work in, you know, landscape and in relationship to food. And those aren't places that I've been able to get yet because my mind is so burdened with all these other things that I haven't gotten to a peaceful place where I can just focus my work on the food that's being eaten off of it. And so what people take for granted is that they're in a place in their life where they don't have to worry about these political things or what they refer to as political things. They can just worry about making pots.
You said this world we live in, and that brings me to something you once said. As a man of color, you fear being pulled over to the point where your wife, who is Caucasian, drives instead of you. And you're quoted as saying, I am very afraid of the world we live in. And I'm wondering to what extent that fear and sensitivity influences everything you do as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, it really does influence everything in terms of what I make. I mean, I'm really... Man, I'd hate to say that I cry because saying that I cry really takes away the genuineness of it. But I find myself in the studio a lot of times sobbing at something that happened circumstantially. Like I made a painting of Mike Brown once, and the idea was not to be directly political, but just to make an urn for him, saying that he was worthy of having an urn made.
And of course, he was shot also by police.
And so, when I painted him, I woke up, and artists have this moment. I think a lot of people, students especially, would have this moment where you wake up and you realize you'd been doing something for hours and you can't remember it. So I painted this thing and I didn't remember it because I fell asleep while I was drawing it. And I painted my face so much on my pottery that when I looked at this portrait, I said, oh no, I painted my portrait on this pot. And then I realized it wasn't me, it was Mike Brown. And we just have such similar features. And it was like 3 o'clock in the morning at that point, and I just started sobbing, thinking to myself about several times that I'd been pulled over and how close I was to a similar fate. You know, just to give folks an example, my wife is white, and so when we first met, I would tell her about how often I get pulled over by police, and she laughed at me. She's like, "That's not true. You know, you're exaggerating." And I think within a 3-month period, I got pulled over 4 times. And then at one point, I get pulled over, and it was in Macon, Georgia, and they asked me if they could search my car. They had already called a K-9 unit, and I was trying to explain to them that I was just visiting my parents and that I make pottery, and, you know, I was trying to give them things about myself that would sort of take away a lot of the stereotypes. And one of the things I thought of to say was, like, "I'm a ceramic artist, like, I make pottery, like, I'm a good guy," you know, and they just, like, laughed at me, they were at this point where I was so afraid to even get out of the car, but I knew if I didn't get out of the car, that would be my death. So I just put my hands on the steering wheel and asked them to help me get out. Like, "Can you open the door for me?" Kept my hands on the car the entire time. And even when they said I could go, I was still afraid to, like, move my arms. And those things haunt me. Like, I shook. We drove to Florida. We're driving to Florida from Pennsylvania. I was shaking the whole time, and let her drive, because I felt like I was so close to being killed. But that's a bad experience, and I've had really good experiences with police. And so I have a series of work that I made with both of those. Like, I'll have the positive sort of experience, like once a police officer pulled over and drove me home when I was lost in South Philadelphia, and I was just a teenager working, and there was no bus that day. And to calm me down, he asked me about sports, and he was, like, trying to help me and make me feel better. And I was just thinking, this person is also a police officer, and he's who a lot of people identify when they say things like Blue Lives Matter. And so I can understand why they get so offended when folks say bad things about police. And so at the end of the day, I'm realizing that it's not about police. It's just about folks that have this sort of superiority. And because they have that complex, they wind up applying for jobs like police so that they can really push in their ideals. And so it's not about the job. It's just about the individual people.
You know, so much of your work has been influenced by an incident like the one you just described. You talk about driving home or driving back to Penn State campus once between semesters and stopping at a gas station and overhearing what could only be called racial slurs or microaggressions. And that resulted in your creating this teapot that had a Confederate flag on it. And I want you to tell us more about it. But what you had in mind was that this teapot, you hoped, would start a conversation. Explain what he said and what you hoped would happen.
Yeah, I mean, it was really just a moment, normal moment that most people have, you know, when they're on their way to school and they want to drink and they stop. And then there's this conversation that happened between this person who was just really overtly dressed in things that symbolize that he didn't care for folks like me, like camo and Confederate stuff. And just, you know, and then literally the words that he said, he used a racial slur to talk about someone
who had just won a lottery.
Who just won lottery and how upset he was that this illegal person, which, you know, he just referred to as a derogatory term for a Spanish person. And so that got me thinking. I was on my way to the studio and I said to myself, there's no way that I could ever win a conversation with that person because they already believe in what they believe in. There's no way to really get them over to my place of understanding. And then I said to myself, but they probably feel the same way. They probably feel like they can never get someone like me to understand their side of things. And so sometimes that comes through in conversation, like they have some superiority, but maybe in reality he has an inferiority complex and he's been wronged by people of color in some way or another, and then uses that to, you know, stigmatize them. And so I said to myself, what I really need to do is figure out how to be in between and how to have a conversation with this person. And maybe the way to do that is by doing things that represent them to be able to spark this conversation, and things that represent myself so that I can sort of be in this liminal in-between space where new conversations can be had. Because if we're sort of just conservative people listening to Fox News and liberal people listening to CNN, we never know why people are doing the things that they do. But I actually find myself listening to both sort of news stations so that I can get a better understanding of things. And then that really helps me to become a better artist and just a better empathizer, which I think is really important to being an artist.
And not necessarily a literal conversation with this person who made the offending remarks. But that makes me wonder about what it's like for you to see people viewing your art. There is a lot of Roberto Lugo ceramics at the Wexler Museum in Philadelphia, for example. And I imagine that at some point in your career, you've sat back and watched people interact with it.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm really grateful that many of the interactions have been positive ones. You know, one example was this woman came to my show in Philadelphia, and she was, her family were immigrants, and she saw this vase I made online called the Refugee Century Vase, and an image that I used on it reminded her of her family and the struggle that they had when they came. And I believe she was in her 90s, and she just came to the show just to give me a hug, and she left. But I had never expected that scenario to happen and for people of all walks of life to really relate to my work. And I think for the most part, the only, like, substantially negative things that have happened have just come through, like, social media trolling and just folks who really just want attention, so they say really negative things. So I've sort of cut off social media for the time being because it affects me really negatively.
You know, I'm curious to know how you take Donald Trump's budget proposal that would kill all funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. I don't know. We don't know yet whether Congress will sign off on that or not. But how concerned are you that the arts in this country are really on the chopping block?
You know, I feel like what happens with folks like Donald Trump when they have a real extreme sort of take on things is it winds up making people putting a fire under them to get things done. And so I'm sort of seeing people gather and fight back in ways that I've never seen within my lifetime. And so much conversation is happening about how to keep the arts going that I've never been a part of or have seen. And so I think this is making people really desperate, and I think great things happen in these times of desperation. And then on the other side of things, I think people who support this, if there were to be a time where arts funding were to be cut, I think that they would see the effects of it. And, you know, in some ways, they'd realize how much art plays a role in their life. Because so many times people think that art is just sort of these really eccentric folks that go to school that dye their hair. But then they, you know, they really love the opera and they really love chamber music, and they don't realize, oh, that's part of it. You know, you really love landscape painting, plein air, that's part of it. You love that handmade mug that you drink out of every morning, well, that's part of it. And so if you're not supporting the arts, what happens is a lot of these things die out, and we're starting to see that in some ways or another in certain places. And you know, example of that, I was just watching this film, La La Land, and right. I saw them play jazz. And then I was right. like, you know what? I really like jazz. And so because they were talking about jazz being done, it made me like sympathize with it and say, I really like this music. I got to figure out how to support it. I'm going to buy some jazz albums. So, you know, I don't support what he's doing with cutting this art funding. But at the same time, I think what people don't realize is that artists thrive in times where they have to be resilient, and it just makes them work harder. And so I think at the end of the day, even if they cut it, it's only going to be temporary because people are going to realize how important
it is. They can't live without it.
Yeah.
All right. Roberto Lugo, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Artist Roberto Lugo earned his MFA from Penn State. Today, he's a professor of ceramics at Marlborough College in Marlborough, Vermont. To hear more of this conversation or other artist interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.